Congress Chair Omtvedt, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Jean Guevin, Managing Director and Head of the BlackRock Investment Institute. Prior to joining BlackRock, Jean was Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada, as well as Canada's Associate Deputy Finance Minister. I had the great pleasure and fortune to get to know him in that period. In that powerful finance position, he had a wide range of responsibilities, including for Canada's budget and representing his country at the G7, G20, and Financial Stability Board. He also chaired the G20's Framework Working Group, created in the wake of the crisis to promote strong, sustainable, and balanced global growth. Welcome, Jean. So you've just co-authored an outstanding, thought-provoking paper with Stan Fisher, Phil Hildebrand, and Elga Bartsch, truly an all-star team, in which you put forward a rather radical vision for the conduct of monetary and fiscal policy. The paper has been widely read and commented on. Congratulations. Before we dig down, could you give us a one-minute high-level overview of your thesis, and then we'll break it down?
So maybe even just the reason why we felt that it was important to work and write this piece. I think we're coming at it from the starting point, which is that we don't think we have clarity on how we're going to be able to deal with the next downturn. There's a kind of a game plan that is missing. And it's missing because we think that the current set of tools that central banks have, both conventional and now what we call unconventionals, will not be enough to provide appropriate response to a sizable shock, like a recession type shock. And so the question then is, what can be done? What will have to be next? And we think that one way or the other, it will have to involve closer coordination between fiscal and monetary policy. Any kind of solution we can think of will have a flavor of closer coordination. And then what is worrying is that we can see that happening in a way that could be improvised, and in that case could lead to pretty important risks in terms of opening the door for uncontrolled fiscal spending or undermining central bank independence, or it could happen in a more deliberate way and having a plan around it. And we were trying to figure out what could a better plan look like than the first option, which is scary to us.
So therefore, you propose a standing facility for fiscal monetary coordination.
Yes, the actual proposal here is to say what could be a mechanism that will provide the required coordination. And that coordination is ultimately any kind of policy response, in our view, will require to go more direct and put money more directly in the hands of entities that can spend that money. Either there could be companies, consumers, or the government itself. And the question is, how do we then put boundaries around that coordination? And one way that we try to illustrate is it could be done through setting up an emergency facility that would be funded by the central bank. So the size would be determined by a central bank in order to achieve an inflation objective. But how this facility is deployed, whether it's by cutting checks to consumers or giving subsidies to companies or whatever, that part would be a fiscal authority decision. And then by framing that as the emergency facility, then it provides also a context around it. It will be activated under some condition that would need to be satisfied. We can talk about more if you want. And it would also be terminated when some other conditions are met, in particular when the inflation objectives are on track to be met. So it put a boundary on the form of coordination that would be happening only in an emergency situation and for a definite period of time.
So it seems, given falling productivity, lower R-star, lower growth and inflation, demographics, you're correctly worried about persistent stagnation. And this seems like a very valid concern in an era when all one hears about is Japanification and stall speed and the like. On monetary policy, you're surely right that it is overburdened and loses potency at the zero low bound. I think Olivier Blanchard has discussed a reversal rate. But can't monetary policy still help? Can't more forward guidance, more aggressive QE with a broadening set of assets make progress? And what's the central bank to do if the government is of little help?
One important point to clarify is we're here thinking and talking about the next downturn. It's not necessarily here and now. Our view at BlackRock is, you know, we don't see the risk of a recession to be high at this point. It's not so much about the current situation, where there is still some scope to adjust policy and tweak and maybe to provide some additional easing within the current toolkit. But when the significant slowdown occurs, we don't think there's enough room left to respond. And the reason there, I mean, you've talked about reversal rate and what Olivier Blanchard has discussed and Larry Summers and others. What all of the toolkits that the central bank has or have worked towards reducing or lowering some interest rates. And if the policy rate or the short-term rate cannot be lowered further, then we've been embarking in QE and forward guidance to try to signal lower longer-term rate and implement lower longer-term rates. But we're at the point now that across the entire yield curve, we're reaching levels that we don't think can go much lower. We don't think, first, because in Germany, getting to a negative 60, 70, 80 basis points is technically feasible, but we don't think it can go much farther than that. In the U.S., we think it's going to be even more difficult to go negative. And I think we're reaching a point where the adverse impact of these low rates is starting to become more visible. So as a result, we don't see enough room both for conventional and unconventional policies. What is the central bank to do in that case? We think there's a risk that they're going to be pushed. If there's no deliberate plan under pressure, we think that central banks will be pushed in directions where they're going to be blurring more and more the fiscal monetary policy distinction. We could all even point to the crisis response where some of these boundaries have been broached, where credit easing or central banks buying equities has a lot more of a fiscal flavor, and there's a danger that when pushed under pressure, we're going to go farther in that direction. And the question is, how do we put guardrails around that? But I think in reality, to wrap up, is we don't see enough room for the toolkit that central banks have. There will be a temptation to be more creative and have central banks step over more and more on the fiscal side, and that thing that can be pretty slippery, dangerous slope.
So you rightly argue fiscal policy should be playing a more supportive role, and it's not nimble. Now, obviously, a country like Germany has fiscal space and should use it. Others are with high debt, France, Italy, and even the U.S. to some extent are seen as having limited or no space. But given the crisis and given the global demand for safe assets and the like, should we be rethinking fiscal space and our notions of what the limits to fiscal policy are?
So it is the case that the environment right now, I think certainly in some part of the world, is conducive or favorable to use more of the fiscal lever than we've seen. It is possible to even, if the current condition were to persist, you could even argue that it's possible to have an expansionary fiscal policy while at the same time we're seeing debt to GDP declining, given the extremely low cost of financing debt in this environment. And that's why there's been like vocal colleagues that have been making the case for more of a fiscal support in this environment. The question, though, for us is that if the case is so obvious, why is that happening? Or it hasn't happened as much. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about monetary policy having been overburdened during the recovery and supporting this expansion, despite the low rates. So there's a question about, even if the case is strong, it doesn't seem to be happening automatically. The second aspect is that fiscal policy is difficult to deploy in a nimble fashion. And so that also leads to some skepticism about that being the whole solution. And a third element is that it's not clear for us that we can simply assume that the current conditions will persist in a world where we are starting to use the fiscal lever a lot more. And in particular, it's not clear that interest rate will stay this low in a world where fiscal policies start to be significantly more expansionary. And it is particularly the case where in countries where debt is high. We know we are at record levels of debt globally. The questions around how sustainable that can be, I don't think can be assumed to just be ignored in a world where we were moving more aggressively with fiscal support. So that's why, I mean, fiscal is part of the solution, but it requires some more explicit coordination with the monetary policy side of things, because we cannot guarantee that rates will stay as low as they are.
And I think that you've basically outlined why you propose going direct with stepped up fiscal monetary coordination. You also discuss in your paper why helicopter money, so-called, could unleash concerns of its own about inflation, governments compromising central bank independence, and that's why you proposed a standing facility, as you outlined for us earlier. And you've said that this isn't a proposal for the here and now, per se, but for the next shock. Do you differentiate in your mind between Japan, Europe, and the United States in your thinking about the need for such a facility or for going direct?
Well, one version of the question is which country will push first in that situation. And I think the boundary or the limits are closer in Europe and in Japan than they are in the US. So the US has a bit more room than the other countries. So yeah, I think there is some differentiation to be made here. Now, the other aspect I would say is that it's not obvious, or I don't think we should necessarily take for granted that the sequencing of how we deploy these policies wouldn't necessarily have to be the way that happened. So if we had in place such a standing facility, or if we had had that in place before, it's not clear that the optimal thing would have necessarily been to go as deep into low and negative rates. And I think this is an open question, but don't necessarily have necessarily the work or the, like, an established view yet. But if we were able to stimulate the economy without relying on rates being this low and across the entire yield curve, it might have attractive feature. It might be putting less pressure on savers, pensioners, and so on. And so having this facility in place, or having had it in place, we might have decided to do a different sequencing of the policies, and with that, instead of going from lower conventional policy rates to forward guidance to QE and then to negative rates and to yield curve control, maybe there's an alternative sequencing that would be available if we had this facility in place. And the fact that we would have it in place is a bit like Paulson's analogy during the crisis. If we had this bazooka, we might not have to deploy it, and we might not have to rely as much on negative and low rates. So yeah, I do see a differentiation across countries, and I also see a differentiation that it's not, the game plan doesn't have to be the one we've seen if we had that in place.
I'm always amused by the references to the Paulson's bazooka, because we actually had to fire it, if I recall. But you've described the strengths of such a proposal, but you and I, having been former bureaucrats, the first things we would have asked our teams is, okay, what are the pros and cons? Great idea. What are the weaknesses? And there clearly would be political economy questions around this, legal and political obstacles for sure in the U.S. There's a question in my mind about whether it would be realistic to think that central bank independence could be protected if we went down this path. Do you have any further thoughts on the pros and cons of the proposal? And if you were being a good policymaker, how would you tote both sides up?
So I think the absolutely right that the political economy around this is a huge question, and we don't want to underplay that. There's very tricky governance issues that we need to be sorted out. The legal framework is, we tried to explore a bit of that in the paper, but I mean, this requires a lot more work and thinking. We don't want to trivialize the complexity of putting that in practice. I think our goal here was to try to illustrate what we think the features of that coordination will need to be, and of some contours of what kind of responsibility the central bank should have versus the fiscal authority. I think what's important here and what's novel is that it's not like we're in a world where the central bank has an instrument and the fiscal authority has a separate instrument and they are coordinating the two instruments. So what we're talking about here is one instrument that has an aspect of monetary policy and that has an aspect of fiscal policy, and then the two authorities need to kind of agree on how to use that instrument, which makes that trickier. So yeah, there are 20 issues to be satisfied or to be figured out, but I think the key point is that the size of the facility is something to us that looks more like a monetary policy decision. This is about, this is akin to liquidity injection, which is something that the central bank should have a greater say on and should be able to terminate to avoid uncontrolled inflation. But the actual deployment of these facilities, because they will lead to redistribution, there's an inequality aspect, these are clearly part of the decision that should be squarely in the hands of the government and the fiscal authority. Now, the other part of your question was, can we really, you know, ensure central bank independence if we go down in that direction? I'm going back to a point I've made a bit earlier, but which is that at the end of the day, under pressure, we have a strong belief that it's going to happen. There's going to be a blurring of the distinction. And as we blur it without a plan, we'll be undermining the central bank accountability and independence. We'll make central banks more politicized by nature. And we've seen already some of that happening. And the only way to, in our view, to really address that is to recognize that this is going to be the name of the game going forward. And it's better to try to put a framework and a contour around it, which is a world that is more complex than the one we would like to live in. But it's probably the more realistic world. And the way to manage central bank independence in that context is to proactively recognize that there's going to be more of a need of a coordination and try to put a framework around that. But it is tricky. And again, don't want to trivialize this coordination aspect.
It's a fantastic paper you've written. It shows innovative thought, stimulated discussion. The world needs innovative thinking in this day and age. This is a valuable contribution, no matter how one feels about the pros and cons of this, which you've very fairly and realistically outlined. Thank you, Jean Bavon, for joining us today and for a fascinating podcast.